affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a U.S. Army recruiter in Portland recently signed up an autistic man. Demonstrators are in the streets, even as we speak, to call attention to what they call recruiter abuse. Bush's new CIA chief is a military general who officially authorized the NSA wiretapping program. And Nigerian medical experts have conclusively proven the Pfizer Corporation tested dangerous experimental drugs on impoverished Nigerian children.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,422 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 39,258 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Statistical experts estimate that number may be short by as many as 200,000 deaths. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 8th, 2006. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Woolner.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. News came this weekend that a U.S. Army recruiter in Portland has signed up an autistic man for one of the most dangerous tours of duty the military offers. The man's parents are now working to remove him from the military's rosters. It remains unclear whether they'll succeed. Meanwhile, at this hour, the Portland Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition is holding a march and rally to end military recruitment abuse, starting at Holiday Park near the Lloyd Center and passing by the Military Recruitment Center on Northeast Broadway. Then the group plans to march to the school board meeting at the Blanchard Education Service Center at 501 North Dixon Street. Organizers say it's their first step in convincing the school board to establish a uniform policy for access to students. For more information on the Portland Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition, call Mary Ann at 503-515-6753 or email pamrcoalition@yahoo.com.
The Oregon State Police Association is apparently not campaigning on behalf of Republican gubernatorial candidate Kevin Mannix. That was in doubt last week when phone messages from Mannix's campaign for governor listed a wrong number on caller IDs. While the message urged voters to cast their ballot for Mannix, the caller identification showed the phone number of origin to come from the police association. Mannix campaign manager Stan Pulliam says it was simply an auto-dial glitch. He says auto dials are usually reliable, but the system was programmed with an incorrect phone number. The Oregon State Police Association began receiving complaints Thursday and referred all questions to the Mannix campaign. Pulliam said he wasn't certain how many calls with the wrong ID were made, but the auto dial went to Republicans statewide. Pulliam says the Mannix campaign sent volunteers to the Oregon State Police Association to help them field extra calls associated with the error.
Bicyclists will be riding this month in several Oregon towns to remind drivers to look out for people pedaling. They will join a nationwide movement called the Ride of Silence. It's scheduled May 17th. During the ride, bicyclists will remain silent and go no faster than 12 miles per hour. In Corvallis, organizers plan a 7-mile route through downtown. One of the organizers is Debbie Jensen. Her 18-year-old daughter, Robin, was pedaling home from her job as a lifeguard in 2004 when she died in a hit-and-run crash. Rides are also planned in Newport, Salem, Pendleton, and Phoenix.
The state economy could get a multi-million dollar boost from wind power development in Umatilla County, according to a new report. Wind energy has the potential to grow into a $40 million business and bring new jobs to the rural communities if local infrastructure is developed, according to the study by the Oregon State University Extension Service. Oregon State researchers used economic models developed by the National Energy Renewable Laboratory and the university to estimate the current and future impact of the wind energy industry. Umatilla County has the capacity to generate about 480,000 megawatt hours of wind energy per year, or enough energy to power about 46,000 Oregon homes.
They are late, but the spring Chinook salmon appear to be returning on the Columbia River. Wildlife officials say the counts at Bonneville Dam have been at 1,000 or more for the past 2 weeks. Officials aren't sure why, but the spring run this year is the latest on record. Kurt Melcher of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Department says it's too early to predict the size of the run, but he said it might be 60,000 or more. Before the season began, the prediction was for 88,000 fish.
Oregon workers' compensation officials recorded 31 workplace deaths last year. Those are deaths in jobs covered by the state's workers' compensation. It doesn't include workers such as those who are self-employed or who work for the federal government. The U.S. Bureau of Labor will have a complete report in the fall. But among the jobs that workers' compensation covers, the number of workplace deaths is the lowest since the state began keeping track in 1943. In 2004, the department recorded 46 workplace deaths. During the 1990s, the department recorded 81 deaths per year. Motor vehicle accidents accounted for the largest number of deaths in 2005. There were 8 deaths on the road.
The rising cost of textbooks is an issue often overlooked in debates about student debt. But across the country, student activists and lawmakers are quietly working to force textbook publishers to stop inflating the costs of required books. KBOO volunteer Ava Hegedush is Portland State University's Affordable Textbook Campaign Coordinator. Excuse me, that is, it's not run by Portland State University, It's run by the Public Interest Research Groups. And she's our campaign coordinator, and she's live with us here in Studio 2. Ava, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks.
First, outline why the issue of college textbook prices is so important. Are the publishers really cheating to drive up the costs?
Well, our research shows that students are spending approximately $900 a year on textbooks. And that's a really large percentage of what they're paying for their overall cost of tuition and supplies. It's about 26% of what a student will pay for their overall cost at a four-year public university, and it's actually about 72% of what they pay at a community college. And what we find is that this is a tipping point that is making education unaffordable for students and restricting access to higher education.
There's been a recent development on the issue in Connecticut. Talk about that.
Well, I think it's important to understand before discussing the legislation in Connecticut, a nuance of the textbook market, which is that the textbook market is really unique in that it's one of the only markets where the consumers don't have any direct control over the prices of what they're purchasing. And that is to say that anybody who's taken a class knows that the professors are the ones who decide which books the students will have to buy. And as it stands right now, the textbook publishers don't make their pricing information available to those professors. So they're deciding which textbooks the students have to buy without actually knowing how much they cost. So sometimes that leads to the professors unintentionally ordering really expensive books that they later find out are costing their students an arm and a leg. What the legislation in Connecticut does that just passed last week is it requires that the textbook publishers actually make those prices available to the professors so that they can make an informed decision about which books they'll require their students to purchase.
Where are the colleges themselves and the college bookstore managers on the issue? Do they support the rising prices, or are they generally on the student side?
Well, I don't think there's one unified response from the colleges and the college bookstores. What we do know about college bookstores is that their profit margin is in line with other retail outlets. So the bookstores themselves are not making an outrageous profit. Most of the profit is going to the publishers themselves. And we have seen some great examples of the bookstores working with the students to keep the textbook prices low.
What are the kinds of activism that people in Portland are putting together on this?
Actually, Portland Community College is on the leading edge of this. They have a great coalition that they've put together at the Portland Community College campus that involves the students, student government, the bookstore, financial aid, and the administration to try to come up with purchasing guidelines at the university to help keep the textbook prices low. In addition to that, students are coming up with their own textbook swaps online and also at the university so that they can have control over what the prices of their books are. And in some cases, students are working together with their professors to try to negotiate lower prices on their textbooks.
All right. Thank you, Ava. That was Ava Hegedush. and she's for the Public Interest Research Group's Affordable Textbooks Campaign Coordinator. And thanks for coming to KBOO. For more information, you can go to www.maketextbooksaffordable.com.
Health experts say there is little risk from the low level of arsenic found in 5 drinking fountains at Seattle schools. But the district wants to reassure parents, so bottled water is being used in all 100 public schools in Seattle while the source of the toxic element is traced. The arsenic was found in new fixtures that were installed to fix a lead contamination problem at school drinking fountains. Only one of the fountains had been used, and for just 8 days. Spokeswoman Patty Spencer says investigators are checking metal in the pipes and fittings. University of Washington environmental health professor David Eaton says the long-term risk of harm from the low level of arsenic is very low. Eaton suspects the arsenic may be coming from plumbing fixtures with lead-free solder. The Seattle School District has spent $13 million over the past several years replacing 1,000 fixtures to reduce lead and copper contamination.
The Army's first striker brigade that spent a year in Iraq is headed back next month. The 3rd Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division, is finishing training at Fort Lewis. Nearly half of the soldiers went to Iraq in 2003 for the first time. The veterans say they have a better understanding of the Iraqi culture and more training to deal with insurgents. They'll replace the 172nd Striker Brigade Combat Team from Fort Wainwright, Alaska, that has been in Iraq since September at Mosul and on the Syrian border. The 3rd Brigade's operations officer says the mission and locations are likely to change as U.S. forces hand over day-to-day responsibilities to Iraqi troops. The brigades are built around the 8-wheeled Striker vehicles, which are used as rapid reaction forces.
The InSightU group, maker of a small unmanned surveillance plane for the military, has received $23 million in venture capital. The company in the small eastern Washington town of Bingen will use the financing to develop a new aircraft for commercial uses, such as deep-sea fishing, mineral exploration, and wildlife tracking. The company developed the Scan Eagle for the Navy and Marines. The remote-controlled 4-foot plane can fly over a battlefield and send information to troops on the ground. The Navy uses it to monitor ships near oil platforms in the Persian Gulf. The company has produced 190 of the aircraft so far. It has 170 employees, making it one of the largest private employers in Clickitat County.
The Union for Employees of the Seattle Times and Post Intelligencer voted to end its support for the Committee for a 2-newspaper town. Union members say the committee was undermining efforts by the papers to arbitrate differences over their joint operating agreement. The union provided 80% of the money for the committee. A leader of the committee, Ann Bremner, says it will need donations from others to continue an antitrust cause. The Times is trying to end a 23-year agreement under which it handles all the business operations for both papers and takes 60% of the profit. The Times says the arrangement is causing it to lose money, but the PI says it can't survive without the JOA.
A group of House Republicans plan to submit an amendment this week to strike down a 1965 Voting Rights Act provision that includes bilingual ballots and translation assistance at the polls. FSRN's Selena Musuta reports from Montgomery County, Maryland, an area that has seen a boom in immigration and, along with it, a demand for adult English classes.
In Montgomery County, over 2,200 people are on waiting list for English classes. Tom Perez was part of a state task force last year that recommended Maryland increase their comprehensive funding of adult education programs, including English for Speakers of Other Languages, or ESOL, by $26 million over 4 or 5 years, starting with $5 million next year. However, the Montgomery County members' statewide proposal was not adopted, and instead, adult education programs saw only a $1.5 million increase. So Perez turned to his county, which currently spends $1 million on adult education, and proposed that it spend an extra $300,000 to move 600 of the 2,200 people off the waiting list and into English classes.
With this investment, county government will be on par with the federal investment. There's something wrong with that picture. When county government is on par with the federal investment and is 4 times larger than the state investment, We need equal partnership at a federal and state level. We will continue to do our best. And a $300,000 increase above and beyond what we already spend is a very significant down payment.
The money, if passed, would pay for new teachers and their training, materials, and classroom rentals.
And arm, leg. Do you understand?
Every Saturday morning at the Gilchrist Center for Cultural Diversity in Wheaton, Maryland, Lucy Classley spends 3.5 hours teaching beginners English to a group of students from mostly the countries of El Salvador, Peru, Gabon, and Thailand. Most of her students work 2 or 3 jobs and support families in the U.S. as well as in their home countries, something Classley says should be considered when arguing to make English classes more accessible.
I think having classes in as many libraries, as many public buildings as we can, or apartment basements, to just have it available. Because I don't see how we can expect people to come to this country and learn English if they don't have the means. I mean, most of them come with not a lot of money.
Immigrants are not the only ones who lack resources, says Mary Freeman, the head of the Montgomery County's Coalition for Adult Literacy, and ESOL, a group of 50 service providers that teach 16,000 people a year.
There are opportunities to study English. However, most of them, and particularly the community-based organizations, cannot meet the demand. So they have a certain amount of space, a certain number of teachers that they can have a budget for, and they have to turn people away.
Supporters of ESOL programs like Rich Tomitz, a developer and an advisory member of the Adult Literacy Coalition, say that immigrants who know only limited English face greater dangers in the workplace, especially in the construction industry.
A lot of our industry is under very complex regulatory and safety laws that need an understanding of English in order to provide for maximum worker safety and maximum implementation of laws and quality controls.
The Montgomery County Council will vote on the final 2007 operating budget on May the 25th. For FSRN in Rockville, Maryland, I'm Selena Masuda.
The time is 5:17, and now, commentary by Seattle Weekly columnist Jov Parrish.
Immigrants and hate. This is Jov Parrish. Monday, I was busy for most of the day helping provide security for the massive immigrant rights march here in Seattle. Organizers were concerned about a steady stream of virulent, anonymous death threats in the days leading up to the march, directed both at organizers and march attendees, and they didn't have nearly enough security to protect people adequately against such threats. Their fears, as it turned out, were well justified. At one point in the march, a car plowed into the crowd. A passenger in the car later called the driver's decision to drive into a street jammed with people a, quote, mental lapse. And, as the Seattle Post-Intelligencer reported in the 21st paragraph of their story, Seattle police reported the total of 7 people were arrested during the march, and those included 5 people for possible weapons violations. SPD said all 5 may have had permits for the weapons, however, and they've been released. That was fairly typical local media coverage. What SPD apparently did not say, but any organizer could have and perhaps did tell any local reporter whom cared to ask, was that the 5 were not marchers, as the PI's story intimated. They were self-identified neo-Nazis. And in the context of the large number of death threats organizers had received, there's only one possible explanation for their having come to the march armed with guns. It was march security that brought their presence to the attention of SPD. SPD also chose not to reveal, and no local media reported, a fact announced from the rally stage later on, that the car incident had resulted in several injuries. Seattle police were reportedly irritated with march organizers because the organizers, all of whom were non-white and most of whom were immigrants, for some reason didn't especially trust the police during the previous April 10th march here. So, among other things, SPD chose not to block traffic at intersections during the first 2 non-downtown miles of the march route along Jackson Street. And then we had a car injuring marchers. Happily, most marchers had no idea all this was going on. The massive turnout was both joyful and inspiring. But the failure in particular of SPD and local media to report what was apparently a neo-Nazi assassination plot is more than just bad news judgment. It's a fundamentally biased news decision that lets the current wave of immigrant bashers and immigrant hating off the hook. Nationally, these were not isolated incidents. There's a direct line between the blatant misinformation and often racist xenophobia of media icons like Lou Dobbs, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and the whole Fox crew, and a wave of rapidly reactionary local talk show hosts across the country, and the actions of our neo-Nazi friends here in Seattle. Connect the dots. There's plenty of room for disagreement on what to do about immigration policy in this country. The current system is clearly broken, with laws not being enforced and cheap labor often being badly exploited. What there is not room for in this debate is epidemic misinformation, xenophobic hatred, and fear of the visible edge of a world that is steadily encroaching on America's bubble. For the entire history of this country, starting with the genocide of Native Americans and the horrors of slavery, this country has prospered from the use of resources that properly belong to others. Now, finally, the world has no more unclaimed territories or obscure backwaters, and it's become small enough that we can no longer pursue such policies elsewhere in the world without blowback, whether it be 9/11 or a burgeoning immigrant workforce produced by policies that decimate foreign economies. We can no longer build enough walls to keep ourselves fully insulated from the consequences of our actions elsewhere. We'd be much better off, policy-wise, not even expecting that we can. And culturally, the world is changing. Get used to it. For KBOO, this is Jav Parrish.
The country's largest gynecologist group is advising women to get an advanced prescription for emergency contraception. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists is trying to increase access to the morning after pill. It cuts the chances of pregnancy by up to 89% if used within 72 hours of rape, condom failure, or simply forgetting routine contraception. The sooner it's taken, the more effective it is. But sometimes women can't get a doctor to write a prescription in time, especially on weekends and holidays. The ACOG is providing its 49,000 doctors with waiting room posters that urge women of childbearing age to ask about a prescription they could keep on hand. The Bush administration has refused to allow the pill to be sold over the counter.
Oregon senators are getting the chance today to vote on a bill that critics say will dramatically restrict ordinary citizens' ability to hold doctors, hospitals, and HMOs accountable for negligence. KBOO's Spencer Raymond has more.
Oregon voters have twice rejected plans that would put caps on medical malpractice awards. Today, the U.S. Senate is voting on another bill that would do just that. The new proposal would again limit most damage awards to about $250,000. Preempt state laws, and shorten the amount of time injured patients have to file claims. Opponents of the legislation say it drastically reduces patients' rights to hold health care providers accountable. Mark Ungler, whose mother died in a Medford hospital when a drug was wrongfully administered, says the legislation is misguided.
There's no accountability to the medical system. They just want to hold the patient accountable. They want to take the patient's rights away, allow the medical system to continue on their business.
National Academy of Science Institute of Medicine estimates that as many as 98,000 people die each year from preventable medical errors. Supporters say the bill would provide less expensive care for patients by reducing the liability against health care providers. Ungler says laws like this deprive people of their rights.
What they're trying to do is taking away the ability of our country to be a democracy and the juries being able to make decisions for the citizens and the better well-being and the welfare of this country.
Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBOO News.
Republicans in the U.S. Senate have proclaimed this will be Healthcare Week. One of the issues at the center of healthcare debate is how to make insurance more affordable to small businesses. The Senate is set to vote on a bill sponsored by Wyoming Republican and Chairman of the Health Committee, Mike Enzi. Democrats, however, claim they have a better solution. FSRN's Yanmei Shi has more from the Capitol.
Senators Richard Durbin from Illinois and Blanche Lincoln from Kansas authored the Democrats' proposal for a small business health insurance program. Senator Durbin says their plan is modeled after the successful Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, which provides health insurance coverage to members of Congress and federal employees.
The bottom line is, if my health insurance is good enough for a United States senator, it's good enough for every American. And small businesses should have an opportunity to have the same types of policies protecting their employees.
The primary cost-saving strategy in the Lincoln-Durbin proposal is to grant small employers tax credits up to 35% of their insurance cost. In addition, the program would mix small businesses across the nation into one purchasing pool, so that small employers would have more power to negotiate for lower rates. And employers with older and weaker employees can share risk with other participants in the pool. However, President of the American Small Business Association, Todd McCracken, believes in reality the plan would work in just the opposite way.
If you had younger, healthier workers, you'd say, gosh, I'm not going to pay that much for these people. And there would be insurance companies outside of that small health benefit plan that didn't have to have community rating, where you get a better deal. And essentially the young and healthy who are supposed to be subsidizing people would leave that pool.
While the Republican version of the bill introduced by Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming would exempt insurers from most state benefit mandates, the Lincoln-Durbin proposal would retain all state requirements. Pediatrician Mary Ann McCaffrey says the Democratic proposal would be a better alternative for children and families. Dr. McCaffrey serves on the Federal Affairs Committee at the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Their bill retains the state medical benefits so that children and others get health care, for example, immunizations, prenatal care, screening for newborn disabilities, so that their children and other members of their community will be healthy.
The Senate is set to debate on the small business health insurance bill tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Ye Mei Xie.
The Bureau of Land Management will take weeks to sort through thousands of public comments before deciding to grant access to public land for a nuclear waste stockpile at an Indian reservation in Utah. Today was the last day for taking comment on the proposal from Private Fuel Storage. The PFS wants to store up to 44,000 tons of waste above ground at Goshute Indian Reservation, about 50 miles southwest of Salt Lake City. BLM says they received mostly negative comments on the project, including objections from Utah politicians and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. BLM officials say it could take up to 60 days to go through all the comments.
President Bush has nominated General Michael Hayden to head the CIA after Porter Goss's abrupt resignation Friday. Intelligence officials back Hayden's nomination, but Congress members are expressing concern over Bush's decision to place a military man to lead a civilian intelligence agency, and over Hayden's authorization of the controversial NSA wiretapping program. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
First thing this morning, the president announced the nomination of General Michael Hayden to lead the CIA.
He's the right man to lead the CIA at this critical moment in our nation's history.
Hayden was the deputy director of national intelligence under John Negroponte before he was named to replace Porter Goss as CIA director. Goss was reportedly pushed out because of disagreements with Negroponte. This comes less than 2 years after a major reorganization effort began at the CIA and within the intelligence community. Shortly after the president's announcement, Negroponte backed Hayden for the job.
I know that he is the right man for this challenging assignment. He is a reform-minded leader who listens well, makes tough decisions, and understands the challenges of the 21st century.
Negroponte said Hayden will continue to overhaul and expand human intelligence capabilities and coordinate that with other intelligence agencies. He will also be expected to maintain the CIA's expertise on all intelligence analysis. Stephen Coppice will be named as Hayden's deputy. Coppice left the CIA in 2004 over internal politics, which included objections to Goss, according to some accounts. In a short acceptance speech, Hayden attempted to appease congressional members who have expressed concern over his nomination.
In the confirmation process, I look forward to meeting with the leaders of the Congress better understanding their concerns and working with them to move the American intelligence community forward. This is simply too important not to get absolutely right.
Key Republicans and Democrats have said Hayden's nomination won't be an easy pass through Congress. Hayden must undergo nomination hearings in the Senate Intelligence Committee and then be confirmed by the full Senate. Chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Peter Hoekstra, on Fox News Sunday.
I do believe he's the wrong person, the wrong place, at the wrong time.
Hoekstra says that Hayden's background in military intelligence disrupts a necessary balance. Military intelligence focuses on the immediate threat, where civilian intelligence must be able to foresee long-term intelligence alerts and inform policymakers. Furthermore, Hoekstra worries that the ongoing tensions between the Department of Defense and the intelligence agencies could escalate with Hayden's confirmation. Chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Pat Roberts, will not immediately support Hayden. He said the committee must ask tough questions. The president, though, says Hayden's intelligence resume is superior.
He served for 6 years as director of the National Security Agency and thus brings vast experience leading a major intelligence agency to his new assignment.
His authority of the National Security Agency is what worries some critics. Hayden authorized the NSA domestic wiretapping program in September of 2001 and publicly defended it after media reports revealed its existence. Congress is still seeking answers to determine its legality. Senate Judiciary Chair Arlen Specter said on Fox News Sunday that his confirmation process will be an opportunity to find out more information on the secretive program.
This will give us an opportunity to try to find out. If the Senate has a mind to assert its constitutional prerogatives here, then we could use this for leverage to find out. And I think people do want to know what's going on to protect civil liberty.
Congressional members such as Peter Hoekstra and ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, Jane Harman, question if Hayden is too close with the administration. William Christensen, former CIA analyst, says independence from the administration's politics is critical in the intelligence community.
There should not ever be a situation where an administration can tell the intelligence officers, here's the intelligence that we'd like to hear from you.
The Senate is expected to begin preparations for Hayden's confirmation hearing immediately. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company has agreed to pay $5 million to settle a lawsuit brought by the state of California over the company's cigarette giveaways at six public events. Under the terms of the agreement, filed today in Los Angeles Superior Court, the tobacco firm will pay a civil penalty of $3.1 million. They'll also pay $1 million to an organization that funds tobacco education programs and $900,000 to pay for costs incurred by Attorney General Bill Lockyer's office. In a statement, Lockyer says the settlement serves the public interest by holding Reynolds accountable and providing money to further the state's anti-smoking program. The court must approve the settlement before it becomes final. The maker of Camel, Salem, and other brands doled out more than 108,000 packs of cigarettes to nearly 15,000 adults at public events in California, including a San Jose beer festival and a motorcycle event in Del Mar.
The current time is 5:33, and now, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Mother's Day. It's a time when all moms should get breakfast in bed and some flowers, right? Sure. Then all moms should gather up their families and head out for a peace rally to demand an end to the bloody war of lies that's slaughtering so many mothers, sons, and daughters in Iraq. You won't learn it from today's crass commercializers of this annual celebration, but Mother's Day was not meant to be a rose-scented tribute to sweet, docile mom. Rather, it began as a bold cry by mothers for all mothers to rise up against war. In the 1860s, thousands of mothers had been devastated by the brutal slaughter of the Civil War, and many dared to stand up at a time when women could not even vote, to decry war in the name of motherhood, and to urge that all mothers become a force for peace. The original Mother's Day proclamation was penned in 1870 by Julia Ward Howe, the renowned author of The Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Far from the sing-song sweetness of a Hallmark card, this was a stark and clarion call for action. "Arise then, women of this day," it began. "Our husbands shall not come to us, reeking of carnage, for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience." In the spirit of Julia Ward Howe's proclamation, a nationwide group called Code Pink, Women for Peace, will rally in Washington on this coming Mother's Day weekend. There will be a 24-hour vigil in front of the White House, concerts, organizing sessions, and readings from hundreds of poignant letters that mothers have written to Laura Bush, urging the first mother to help stop the war in Iraq. This is Jim Hightower saying, over the long haul, Code Pink is organizing to build the greatest gift a mother could get, a world without war. To join the effort, go to CodePink4Peace.org. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Labor Radio. Tonight's host, Ken Allen, looks at the new prescription drug benefit. Deadline for signing up is next Monday. The benefit was set up to benefit seniors, but Ken says the closer you look, the more it appears the benefit was intended to support the drug industry. At 7, it's Time Sound with Ken Berry. And the weather? Getting warmer and sunnier as the week goes by. In the Willamette Valley, decreasing clouds tomorrow with highs in the mid-60s. In Hood River, the same but slightly warmer, highs near 70 degrees.
In Mexico, the 217 people arrested last week in San Salvador Atenco remain in jail, and many people have begun a hunger strike. The whereabouts of dozens of people remains unknown days after thousands of federal and state police raided the small town near Mexico City. A 20-year-old university student is in a coma in critical condition after a long-range tear gas canister fractured his skull. Women arrested in Thursday morning's raid report sexual abuse, and at least four women say they were raped in police vehicles during the transfer to the prisons in which they are currently being held. Over the weekend, Mexican immigration authorities deported five foreigners picked up during the Atenco raids. Two women deported to Spain corroborated the stories of abuse to the La Jornada newspaper today. The few attorneys that have been able to see the prisoners from the Atenco raid say that many are seriously injured and in need of medical attention. FSRN's Vladimir Flores reports.
Just after a visit inside of the Santiaguito prison, where most of the 217 prisoners are being held, defense attorney Juan de Dios Hernandez comments on what he has seen.
Tenemos compañeros brutalmente golpeados.
We have compañeros who have been brutally beaten. Brutally. It's indescribable. Only seeing them can give you an idea of what these compañeros are suffering. I saw various compañeros now that I went in.
Uno de ellos me impresionó sobremanera.
The level of violence of Thursday morning's police takeover of San Salvador Atenco has instilled a climate of fear in the town. Reporters from Radio Pacheco spoke to a number of townspeople who did not give their names. This woman is a member of the People's Front in Defense of the Land, a group that has been particularly targeted for arrest.
Porque ahorita toda la gente está temerosa.
The people are now scared because of what they came to do here. That's why a lot of people are behind closed doors. But it's a lie that the people of the town don't support us and are in favor of the authorities. It's a lie. Those who are applauding and those who are in favor of them are receiving money. People from here in Atenco who sold themselves for a few coins.
Que se vendieron por unas cuantas monedas.
Many local eyewitnesses to Thursday's raid said that a masked informant accompanied police during the house-to-house searches. This woman chokes back tears as she describes how her family's house was raided.
Se metieron los granaderos ahí con mi mamá y
The riot police broke into where my mother was and created a path of destruction. They brought disaster with them, throwing gases into the room where there were babies, children, and women. They also beat my brothers. One of my brothers was still asleep with his family, and they went into their room, breaking the television, windows, and everything. And the children, I mean, what type of impression does this leave on the children? What impression and what fear? From here on, they will also grow up, and only God knows how they're going to react.
On Friday, the day after thousands of police took the towns by force, some 8,000 people marched to San Salvador Atenco from the outskirts of Mexico City to show the townspeople that they are not alone. At the end of the march, Zapatista Subcomandante Marcos spoke to those gathered in the town square.
Vamos a seguir movilizándonos.
We are going to continue mobilizing. We are going to continue calling on the people to not believe the mainstream media. We are going to keep at it until our compañeros and compañeras are freed, all of them. There are many who are missing from the list of the disappeared, as well as from the list of the detained. But before anything, they need to present them and immediately let them all go free.
Hundreds of supporters gathered in Atenco on Saturday to formulate a plan of action for the coming days. Information brigades will distribute printed material to counteract what is being called a mainstream media lynching. At airtime, Mexico City traffic reports indicate that a large blockade has stopped traffic on one of the main entrances into the capital city. Road blockades and voluntary strikes in the schools and universities are planned for later in the week, as is a major mobilization to demand the release of the prisoners and the physical presentation of the disappeared. With audio from Radio Pacheco, Vladimir Flores reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Just days after the latest South American energy summit, and almost a week after Bolivia nationalized its oil and gas reserves, Venezuela announced yesterday new and increased taxes on foreign companies. Mike Fox has more from Caracas.
On his weekly television show yesterday, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez announced a new extraction tax for foreign oil companies operating in Venezuela. Chavez said the tax could create $1 billion in new revenue. Other tax hikes are in the planning stages for natural gas companies and for the oil companies operating along the Orinoco River. The Orinoco Basin is believed to have extra heavy crude reserves of up to 235 billion barrels. Chavez said that the new taxes are as a result of the fact that with oil prices at record highs, oil companies operating in Venezuela are making a lot of money. Joint ventures operating with Venezuela's PDVSA will be exempt from the new tax, as they are partially state-owned and already pay high royalties. Additional details regarding the taxes are expected soon. For FSRN, I'm Mike Fox in Caracas.
U.S. President George W. Bush has told German TV he would like to close the Guantanamo detention camp in Cuba, but that he's waiting for the Supreme Court to decide how inmates should be tried. Around 490 detainees are being held at the center, which opened in January 2002. There's been widespread international criticism of conditions at the U.S. camp and the length of time detainees have been held without trial. Many have been held more than 4 years without trial. The Supreme Court will decide whether inmates should be tried by military or civilian courts.
The United States has put on trial more than 100 armed forces staff accused of prisoner abuse in Afghanistan and Iraq, twice the number asserted by rights groups, a U.S. official said today. Defending U.S. policy before the United Nations Committee Against Torture, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Charles Stimson said all allegations of mistreatment of detainees were investigated. Figures provided to the committee by U.S.-based group Human Rights Watch showed that there had been only 54 courts-martial for prisoner abuse with 40 armed forces personnel jailed. Are simply wrong, Stimson said. There had so far been 103 such military trials with 89 officials convicted, 19 of whom received jail sentences of 1 year or more, he said. Human Rights Watch Advocacy Director Jennifer Descal said release of the figures was a welcome act of transparency. But the numbers of trials and convictions were still low, given the extent of known abuse, she added.
The aid agency Save the Children claims girls as young as 8 in Liberian refugee camps are still being sexually exploited by aid workers and peacekeepers, despite pledges to stamp out abuse. The agency interviewed more than 300 people living in temporary camps for those displaced by the civil war. They found that many children were being forced to have sex in exchange for food by workers for local and international agencies. The United Nations in Liberia said it would investigate specific allegations.
An infant mortality report released today by Save the Children highlights the need for better education and nutrition among expectant mothers, along with the importance of breastfeeding. It offers cost-effective options, including tetanus shots, which cost about 40 cents, to protect moms and babies against infection, which is found to be the cause of most deaths. Low birth weight and lack of proper care also contribute. The United States had one of the highest newborn death rates, 5 in 1,000. It tied with Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia. The U.S. rate was largely affected by deaths among minorities and poor, rural, uneducated women.
Unemployed graduates in Nigeria are to stage a 7-day hunger strike to protest against the employment crisis in the country. The Unemployed Graduates Association in Rivers State told a Lagos newspaper that the strike would bring public attention to conditions for young people, particularly those without jobs. The association says a survey carried out by them revealed more than 20,000 members are currently unemployed and looking for work. They did not say when the strike would begin.
A panel of Nigerian medical experts has concluded that Pfizer Incorporation violated international law during a 1996 epidemic by testing an unapproved drug on children with brain infections at a field hospital. That finding is detailed in a lengthy Nigerian government report that has remained unreleased for 5 years, despite inquiries from the children's attorneys and from the media. The report concludes that Pfizer never obtained authorization from the Nigerian government to give the unproven drug to nearly 100 children and infants. Pfizer selected the patients at a field hospital in the city of Kano, where the children had been taken to be treated for an often deadly strain of meningitis. At the time, Doctors Without Borders was dispensing approved antibiotics at the hospital.
Last week, the Kingdom of Tonga emerged unscathed from a 7.9 earthquake in the South Pacific. But in a visit to the island nation last month, KBU reporter Michael Jean Horowitz recorded a tremor of a different kind, a political upheaval that by March had replaced the hegemony of a 700-year-old royal dynasty with a liberal democracy led by a Catholic economist. Here's his report.
No one is going to lift our country up. Fijians and Samoans won't do it for us. I believe that this is the beginning of a new era. The political changes are there. Let us all together join hands, unite, and I have no doubt we do that, we're going to revive the economy. We're going to revive the spirit of the Tongans.
The Kingdom of Tonga is a Polynesian archipelago in the South Pacific, whose capital, Nuku'alofa, is located some 1,200 miles northeast of Auckland, New Zealand. There are perhaps 250,000 Tongans on the planet, but only some 100,000 remaining in the island nation. Up until recently, the largely Protestant population was commanded by a 700-year-old royal dynasty in association with some 30 aristocrats. But in early February, a progressive crown prince, acting as royal regent, received the resignation of his younger brother as prime minister and replaced him not with a fellow royal or aristocrat, but with Dr. Filete Savelli, a Catholic commoner who happened to be one of the leaders of the Democratic opposition in Parliament, and the appointment was confirmed by Tonga's king in late March. At Parliament in early April, KBOO was granted the first domestic interview with this economist prime minister since his confirmation. I began by asking Dr. Savelli whether aristocratic government had in any way failed the Tongan people over the past decade.
I think one of the failures of Tongan government in the past has been the distance that it has kept from the people. In the last 10 years or so, the media has played an important part in terms of people's desire to know what's going on. The push for democracy has been strong. So I think the main failure of government has been in not responding adequately to those demands from the people.
Since the late 90s, the value of the Tongan Pa'anga against the U.S. dollar has plummeted from 80 cents to a low of 47 cents, in many cases making foreign fuel, equipment and appliances nearly twice as expensive.
It's been a rough 5 years. I think basically the major problem here in Tonga is that we are spending more than we are earning. In any institution, be it government, family, business, if continually there's more going out than what is coming in, sooner or later, something is going to give way.
Clearly, the kingdom needs to boost trade revenue.
There are basically three areas where we can increase income. We have got marine resources, we have got agriculture, and we have got tourism.
Agricultural specialties include pumpkin, vanilla, yam, taro, and copra. But to comprehensively accelerate export, the Commerce Ministry must methodically
identify the commodities in which we have comparative advantage, commodities that there is an assured market, and then focus on those. And similarly with fisheries, we have got to look at what is it that we have that we can further exploit. Is it sea cucumber? Is it limu? Deep sea tuna.
Good morning to you. This is KBOO that you're listening to. KBOO 90.7 FM.
With its
in
hereditary
Portland.
Nobility.
My name is Jonathan Lay,
partly
and it's
feudal,
time now to bring you Folk Espresso.
One of the difficulties
gears.
In attracting resort chains to its pristine reefs and beaches, for example,
been made possible
has been
in part
that
by
private
KBOO
property
Foundation
in the economic
members,
sense. It's not tolerated in the kingdom.
Dex, your
the
source for local
information.
In the book, on CD-ROM or online at DexOnline.com.
Nothing to prevent us here from giving long-term leases. A 90-day lease is as good as a freehold in all the state time. All leases can be bought and sold. I have invited one of the hotel chains in Fiji to come over and look at Tonga. But once you get a chain here, tendencies for others to follow.
In the late 90s, this report has been produced. Peace Corps volunteer, and then independent. Sociopolitically, today's kingdom is hardly recognizable, now rhetorically committed, even among its ruling class, to joining other democracies in the Pacific. Dr. Savelli's task, which he seems ready, is to reify that rhythm. The KBOO World News, this is Michael J. Harkins, with Tonga's Momi Kayao Prize.
Author of
Michael Kochan, who says that embracing our traditions, values, and teachings conference is geared toward helping natives and healthcare workers in native communities gather information about HIV/AIDS and take that knowledge home to integrate in their communities in a way that fits their own cultural norms.
Some of our communities, the teachings should come from the elders. Some communities, the teachings should come from respected healthcare providers. And sometimes you need a degree to be respected, and sometimes you just need to have the experience.
Tommy Chesbro is Vice President of Education for Planned Parenthood in Eastern Oklahoma and Arkansas. Chesbro has been HIV positive for more than 20 years. Chesbro says advances in medicine have helped people live longer and healthier, but it's not cheap. His medicine at Labcorp costs more than $25,000 per year. He says there is still a lot that is unknown about HIV/AIDS, but there has been progress.
The medications that are currently available have changed HIV from an automatic death sentence to a chronic manageable disease in many situations. So we do the best we can to try to live as healthy as we can. And I'm hoping that someday I'll be an old man. There was a time when I never thought that would happen.
More information is available at embracingourtraditions.com. In Anchorage, I'm Lori Townsend.
As a result of the conference, March 21st, 2007, has been officially declared the first American Indian HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. Meanwhile, the monument erected to remember the 400 people who died in the Midwest drank like tears will be open to the public this summer after all. There's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had closed the Sandy Lake campground because of budget reasons, but as Wisconsin Public Radio's Mike Simonson reports, the Corps has found a way to keep it open.
The announcement last month that the Sandy Lake Recreation Area would be closed stunned tribes from Wisconsin and Minnesota, especially since it was done without consulting tribal leaders. So Army Corps Acting Deputy Engineer Tom Cook reshuffled the budget and found a way to keep the area in north central Minnesota open. Crump says they realized the importance of remembering the black mark Sandy Lake left in 1850.
Very much so, yes. We worked hard with the tribes and with Cliffwick to make the arrangements to get the monument put up in the first place, and we'd love to see it continue to get to the left as allowed to it. So, yes, it is very important.
Cliffwick, or Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission Director Jim Zorn, protested the closing immediately. He says he's happy the Corps found a solution.
There certainly was a reaction from the tribes that were involved in the memorial, as well as some of the individual tribal members and others who have participated in that memorial. It really reinforced the idea that the memorial is, in essence, owned by so many people, and there's so many people who are caretakers of it over the long haul.
In 1850, 5,000 people from 19 tribes in Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin were told to go to Sandy Lake to collect food and money as payment for ceding territory to the federal government. The payments did not come, and 400 people died of disease and starvation trying to return to their homes. In Superior, Wisconsin, I'm Mike Simonson.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Brian Sudersock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, using engineering and science to improve the quality of the environment for over 15 years. RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Our theme music is provided by Jeff Silverman. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Join us this Friday at 6 p.m. for Bread and Roses, the power of the princess.
Join us as we discuss the princess icon and its power to captivate the imaginations of girls across generations, shaping perceptions of self, womanhood, and destiny. Now a billion-dollar business, what messages are passed down?
We'll also take a humorous and analytical look at this country's own princess icon, Miss America.
That's this Friday at 6 p.m. on KBOO.
I want to be princess.
Hey, that's my crown.
No, it's mine.